Let's start right there. Is the woman, this is not on my questions, is the woman on the cover of this album, because I know there's been some issues with her, I can tell.
Yep.
Is she going to live?
She'll be fine. She was uninjured. We didn't, that was, we didn't put her in that position.
Blame it on the label.
It was, it was the artist. That was, we found that. That was a piece from an installation where she wasn't the only person wearing mirrors and stuff. Yeah.
So there were others that have that same that same issue.
Yeah. But they're all fine, apparently.
You've kind of got a bio. You've kind of got a history now. Okay. So what would be kind of fun, and with you, this is going to be a really weird thing to even try, but I'll see what I get.
Make up new information. We're known as a band who doesn't get along. It's much worse than we let on. No,
this is good. This is NME material. Thank you.
No, it's good. I mean, I mean, I'm trying to think as far as what's out there about us that isn't accurate. Go ahead, Bryce.
I think people see us as squeaky clean, as like a bunch of really straight edge guys, but actually we're...
Well, will you go for squeaky or clean? Will you take one of those?
We're not that squeaky. I mean, like people think I'm an alcoholic though, so that's which maybe I am. I don't know. I'm not sure where the borderline of all that lies, but I'm somewhere in the gray area probably. People think we're depressed, you know, like, and that's not always true. We're relatively lighthearted dudes, but our music, for whatever reason, the kind of music that we've been drawn to and love and seem to write that comes naturally is often melodramatic and often dark and often sad and stuff like that. So I don't think the music is a very, very accurate reflection of our personalities so much, you know, or at least it's only one side of our personalities. But
I think Matt's reputation, because of his deep register of his voice, is that he's a dark guy and the lyrics are obviously have darkness in them, but he is a very lighthearted, fun, you know, you're pretty silly, actually. Of all of us, I'd say he's the lightest, and the rest of us are a little darker, but you're the light one.
As I was wandering around my hometown in New York, because I'm a Queens boy, and I went to Williamsburg to see a couple of shows, and I thought, wait a minute, Gowanus isn't gentrified yet. It's not quite there yet, right? It hasn't gotten to Greenpoint, it hasn't gotten to...
It's happened. I mean, Gowanus, they're snatching up all the buildings, and there's, you know, some cool clubs and restaurants, and there's this little cafe. It's happening in Gowanus for sure, but it's still because of the canal. There's like an environment, they've declared that a Superfund site, so there's all this environmental problems.
Yeah, when we started there, when I lived in that loft while I lived there is when they first turned on the water, like got some of the water moving through the Gowanus Canal, and I think it took less than 6 months before, like, life. I mean, it was like, apparently it was the deadest body of water in North America or something, meaning like it had zero oxygen and it was
no fish
and nothing. Not even slime could grow there, whatever. But and it smelled really bad, but they started getting water going through, and I think within 6 months there were like crab, like blue crab, and that had come into the Gowanus. And while we were living there, we actually, from our roof, we on top of this like factory that was an unzoned raw space that I lived in for I guess about six years. But there was a seal that came up the canal and was living outside of our loft for a little while, and we would sit up there drinking beers and watch the seal. Like, I mean, it felt bad because the water was still pretty disgusting, but there was a seal living in the canal for a little while.
When Matt lived in Gowanus, there were people who were doing like insurance scam on their cars would come and like blow them up on his street regularly, so there'd be like burnout cars out front of your apartment.
There were burned out cars. There were people would dump. It was a spot because it was where streets dead end into the canal, so people, there was not much through traffic, so people would come there to do illicit things, and all kinds of things happened down there. And I woke up one night and there was flames coming into the window of our place because a car right underneath the window was burning. I was on the third floor, but they were awful, weird, like dairy trucks would just come and dump gallons and gallons and gallons of milk in the street. went out one morning and there was just this box, right, like a at the end of the dead end street, and it was just in the middle of the street, and it was just sitting there. Just like, it was one of these things that you just like, what? You just the curiosity. I was like, why is that box there? Like, what's it's just sitting right in the middle, and I made the mistake of going over and opening, looking in the box, and there was a. Sorry for the details, but there was a chicken with its head cut off and a double-ended dildo in this box. There's only two items. I don't know.
Did you ever think of renaming the band Double-Ended Dildo?
No, we didn't think of that. But that would have been easier to Google, probably, although you never know.
People forget that this is so far from overnight.
Yeah.
That way before even there was the tip of the iceberg, right? Even when the tip of the iceberg started going away and it became the tip of, oh, it's a nicer place we want to live. It was a long time. It's a long build. And you probably even that many years ago didn't think, oh, we'll never have to work a day job again.
No, I mean, when we started, it was. I mean, I guess it's the same way most bands start, is that you just get a few people together that know how to play some instruments, and then you press record and start collecting ideas that way. And that's the way we did it. And we were having fun. And it was definitely just an escape from whatever, from the various jobs that we had. But we all had pretty relatively serious jobs and didn't ever expect to lose them, or not lose them, but to leave them. But and so when our band started, it was the same time the Strokes started and stuff like that. And we never actually thought we were in that same sort of industry or anything. You know, it was kind of a different thing. We thought of ourselves as like a band that might you know, might have these little obscure records out, and little, you know, which was, it's exciting for us. But I will say that I think we our ambitions grew as we started getting better. I think as our songwriting, we started taking it more seriously, and we all just kind of got addicted to writing songs together, and they started getting better and better. And by our third record, we were getting really good, I think. And so then we started getting more ambitious and hungry, and like that's when we signed to a real label and all that kind of stuff. And it was funny, our idea of what the band would be, like, we didn't get together thinking we were going to be a cool rock band. It was like,
you have never, ever, ever seen yourself as a cool rock
band. I do now.
Finally?
I do now.
Wow. This is news to me.
I don't know. I mean, we were what we thought was cool, you know, meaning I thought, like, you know, the Silver Jews were, you know, cool and, you know, Pavement and all that kind of stuff. And I mean, actually, you know, the Strokes were also unbelievable. They might be one of the cool, you know, top five coolest bands that's ever existed. But that was a different kind of thing that we knew we weren't. But, you know, I think we were always thought of ourselves as like a weird little a little pond off in the far corners of the rock and roll world, you know, very small little pond over there. It was kind of healthy, because we weren't trying to make records that were going to be popular. We were just going to, I mean, we didn't, because we actually didn't have to. We actually had jobs that we were okay paying our own bills, and the jobs weren't jobs that we hated or anything like that. So the band was definitely something, let's just make weird little records that we all just are really excited by. And we didn't, the idea of selling them was kind of a very, very secondary side thing that you know, wasn't until our third record, like, we should probably maybe, you know, sign to a label that can actually reach people or something. But
the other thing is it's, we didn't have, part of our like lack of professional aspiration was like some kind of humility of like not thinking we were ever gonna, never having like expectations about what we would, you know, that we would someday be playing on a big stage or whatever. But we were ambitious about, like, creatively ambitious of trying to make the absolute best record we could make. And that's always been, we have really high expectations amongst each other. So, and we're like hyper self-critical. So that, I think that helped as far as building the, what,
so I've
getting
got
better.
Two here. One is a quote from you, but I didn't dig this up until I did my research this morning. And I just want to know if you've ever run back into the A&R guy who wrote you, Matador has no interest in the National and never will.
Yeah, he got fired.
Of course, I know he got fired. So if you run back into him, he's a
nice guy.
How's it going,
buddy? We know him, and he has worked with some friends of ours over the years. So it's not
awesome.
There's no,
though.
And so I can say hi to him at a. I don't think either of us remember
and
that.
Then he says, "So, have you guys made it yet? You guys doing selling any records? You got any, playing any concerts?"
Yeah, we have stuck around a long time. So there's been certain people who doubted us who maybe didn't stick around as long.
So I read, and this is a quote of a quote, that Trouble Will Find Me was the first album you actually had fun writing, because the sad songs are now out there and admitted to be the sad songs.
The songs and the lyrics for me were coming quicker, and for me, writing lyrics has always been a very slow and sometimes torturous kind of process, because I'm constantly editing myself and it's for me writing the fear of writing bad lyrics was one of the major motivations, or like one of the things that's constantly in my head while writing lyrics. It's just trying to avoid bad ones, and it's really hard to avoid bad lyrics, frankly. It's when you sing any words to music, you just get sucked into cliches and things and melodrama. But I can't, in a funny way, this time I didn't care. I wasn't wondering whether lyrics were good or bad or anything while I was writing. So I was writing a lot and I was writing fast, and mostly just worrying about the melody and focusing more on the melody. And I think that's part of the reason I enjoyed it, is I stopped being hypercritical at the beginning of the process. Later, then you start to trim and edit, and then I got really hard on everything I'd written. Luckily, I also have a very, very opinionated and brilliant wife who's an editor, and so yes. she's really helpful. She was a short story editor, but she can tell in my writing where I'm like, she's like, that's an, you're just
New Yorker, right?
You're phoning it in on that. Yeah, yeah. She edited short stories at New Yorker for 8 years, and maybe the idea that like well, along the way, if I write anything really terrible, she'll catch it at some point. So
it's nice to have an editor.
So in a funny way, I was like, I was spilling out a lot of ideas fast and without being hypercritical of them.
And speaking of process, I know I read this. Let's see if this is accurate. That you rearranged chords from Not Dark Yet, the Dylan song for Slipped.
Yeah, the song Slipped is...
So
not...
rearranged chords. That's an interesting approach to...
Well, that's Dylan's whole career is rearranged chords.
Know,
so,
I know. But it's interesting for the National to kind of...
We've done it before, but we have avoided kind of American tropes of any kind, that things that feel too kind of like classic songbook or too folky or too like Dylan, and partly just because we were navigating this space. We wanted to make... sometimes in Europe they call our sound sort of continental. Somehow it's like,
yes,
it's not American, it's not European, it's something in between.
In some cases, eight different versions or multiple versions of each of these songs that then you wheedle down to the one that's going to be the one.
Pink Rabbits is the one. Yeah,
there were eight different versions of Pink Rabbits, right?
There are eight, and they're all really good. Actually,
well, wait, so,
it's funny,
so
they're all
go.
Pretty good.
It's the one giant B-side. The whole album is the Rabbits B-side.
For whatever reason, I got hooked on that song in a way that I just kept reopening it up and writing and singing again and writing more melodies and stuff like that. And there's something to that one that I got kind of addicted to, and so to the point where those guys had to tell me, like, listen, you got to work on the other songs, because we only need one Pink Rabbits, so